think we'll get started. We're running a little bit behind time, but we're scheduled to go for about 45 minutes, so we've got plenty of time. Welcome to the annual Parliamentary Library budget presentation on how to navigate the budget papers. I'm Jonathan Chance, the Director of the Economic Policy Section in the Library. I'd first like to acknowledge that where we meet today has been a meeting place for the Ngunnawal country and Ngambri people for thousands of years. I'd also like to acknowledge the cultures of any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people present with us today. As for the presentation you're about to hear, we split it into three parts. We have Adrian Makin-Kirchner on the right here, who will explain what the budget is, what the budget documents are and where to find information in them. Liz Wakeley will explain how the economy and the budget interact, that is, how the economy affects the budget in ways the government doesn't directly control. And Phil Hawkins, lastly, will explain how government policy affects the budget. We do cover a lot of ground in these presentations, and if you miss anything, you'll be able to find both the video and all the materials online on the Budget Review website. Furthermore, you can ask us questions by email or contacting the front desk on the number that appears on the flyer on your chair. We'll take questions at the end rather than at the end of each speech or each presentation. I think we'll work better that way. But if you do feel a pressing urge to ask a question because you need to leave, for example, feel free to do that. Hand over to Adrian.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for coming along. Around the time of annual reports last year, we did a bit of a qualitative assessment of budget information. And asked the question, how much budget information is there? We measured it at about 2.15 metres. That includes the annual reports and all the various budget documents that you get on budget day, mid-year outcomes, final outcomes, and those sorts of things. So if you're walking into the lock-up this afternoon and you're feeling a bit overwhelmed, don't worry too much because there's a lot of information. What we're trying to do today is simplify that. As Jonathan said, we've got a lot of things to cover in a relatively short period of time. So what we've tried to do is split it up into the three various parts that you might find the most useful in that budget lock-up context. So if we start at the top, you might have heard terms like the economic toolkit, economic policy, or those sorts of things. So what we've tried to do is unpack the three main levers that are available to the government to influence the economy at any one time. One of them is monetary policy, and that's things like the price of money, interest rates, international exchange rates and those various sorts of things. The second is fiscal policy, which is the taxing and spending environment. Budget is very clearly front and centre in the fiscal policy space. The third major part of the toolkit is microeconomic reform. So that looks at things like productivity in the market sector, deregulation, and also things like competition within certain sectors like banking or airlines or those various sorts of things. Collectively, these levers interact to create an impact, positive, negative, on the way the economy works. And usually, or increasingly, people are looking at that impact across bottom lines like impact on the economy, impact on society, impact on the environment. So to get a real sense for economic policy, we look much, much more widely than just the budget, but today's really focusing just on the budget. At its core, the budget is the most important legal aspect delivers the most important legal dimension of government under the Constitution. So the Constitution sets out the framework by which the Parliament can spend money. There are a number of provisions, and I won't read them out word for word. These slides are available afterwards if you're interested. Most importantly, Section 81 says that all money that the Commonwealth receives forms a consolidated revenue fund. That's supported by Section 83 of the Constitution, which says you effectively can't spend money from the Consolidated Revenue Fund without an appropriation. So to have legal expenditures, the appropriation bills create that environment. Section 54 says, realistically, the appropriation bills are about the ordinary annual services of government, but there are other instruments which we'll talk through. And then Section 55 of the Constitution creates a requirement that all taxation is created effectively within legislation, and that legislation can only deal with taxation. And then finally, Section 96 creates a power for the transfer of funding from the Commonwealth to the states. So the budget, in the pure legal sense, the budget is how the executive engages with the Constitution in terms of money under the Federation. So if we look at those two dimensions, we've got a legal dimension and a policy dimension. As I said, the appropriation bills create the instrument for how Parliament legally releases the funding from the Consolidated Revenue Fund. However, you also get a package of documents, which is the budget paper package. And in that package, you've really got two main things. One is looking at how that appropriation has been distributed across various functions that the government engages with. And the second is that you get the annual statement of the government of the day's policy priorities. So you've got a balance between the legal and the policy or political presentation of financial information. What does that look like in practice? So what I've tried to do here is put together all the various things that sit side by side so you can get a sense for what you're looking at when you're looking at the budget documentation or the legal framework. So on your left-hand side is the breakdown of how the legal dimension or the constitutional dimension of the budget is met. You've got, on budget day, typically what you will get are three appropriation bills. You'll get appropriation bill number one, two, and for parliamentary departments. Appropriation bill number one deals with, and some of these terms we'll discuss later, how departments are funded and how appropriations for administered functions are distributed. Appropriation bill number two covers other wider issues like transfers to the states and territories, non-operating appropriations, and anything that might be a new administered function of government within that budget year would be covered under that environment. There are some other technical things in there, like limits for AOFM and for people who issue Australian Office for Financial Management and other people who issue debt instruments. Those are supported by, later in the year, at budget time, the other part of the budget is a special appropriation, and we'll look at that specifically. But that's really an appropriation for a specific purpose. The third part is taxation legislation. So that exists despite the budget, or it may be influenced by the budget, but there's a package of legislation that creates taxation. And then later in the year, as new information becomes available, particularly around the time of the mid-year economic and fiscal outlook, there'll be subsequent appropriation bills. So appropriation bill 4 and 5 will come out sometime in the middle of the financial year, update appropriation bill number 1 and 2, and create the entire annual appropriation framework that meets the Constitution. Two of the things that are boxed in there for the that are common across each of the appropriation bills and the special appropriations, there are things called the advances to the finance minister. These are ways which we deal with flexibility. I'll talk about those a bit more. And special accounts, again, which I'll talk about those in a bit more. So the budget, from a constitutional perspective, consists of all those instruments that the Parliament deals with and votes on. The policy dimension is spelled out in the what you would, I imagine, a relatively familiar budget documentation. So each of the budget documents does something slightly different. The budget speech is the policy or the political statement associated with that distribution. It also forms the second reading speech of the appropriation bills. So it's actually part of the legislation package. Budget paper number one is the very high-level aggregate kind of information that tells you about what's the aggregate position of the budget, how's the economy interpreted, what are the main functional expenditures of government, and also looks at very long-term trends in various types of expenditures and revenues and components of the budget. That's the sort of, if you're looking at the top-down view of the budget, so if you're interpreting, say, the macroeconomic impact of budget, you'd stick with budget paper one. Budget paper number two gets into the details of the actual policy changes in any one particular year. So there'll be revenue, expense and capital measures spelled out in that document, and you'll get policy statements. And that's a bit more what Phil's going to focus on, so I won't focus too heavily. I should say, Liz will look a bit more at the document one with the economy. The third document, it's relatively thin, but it's the Federal Financial Relations Paper, and that will run you through how the Commonwealth transfers funds to the states and through the states to local government. It's got a breakdown of, you know, the headlines of untied, the various programs like health, education, infrastructure and those bits and pieces. So if you're looking, for example, at, say, national partnership agreements or specific purpose payments, budget paper number three is where you would want to focus. Budget paper number four is it's the connection between the constitutional and the policy side. It breaks down in extremely deep detail how each of the portfolios, departments and entities under those portfolios that aren't departments are funded through the appropriation structure. It also provides a summary of special accounts, special appropriations and staffing. What sits outside of the official budget papers, if you like, or the budget documentation, but is part of the budget package, is the portfolio budget statement collection. You usually differentiate these because they're yellow and they're for a specific portfolio. And what they will do at the level of what happens on the ground, they'll unpack the expenditures and the information that the government presents about. Yeah, there might be an outcome to increase participation in the workforce. There'll be an outcome for that, and that will tell you in detail where the funding is coming from and how it's being redistributed. The budget papers are supported on budget day typically with some fact sheets. They might be, you know, how much, what's the impact of tax on households. There'll be sector papers. So, for example, in the last couple of years, they've published a book on regional Australia, and that it's not actually about the appropriation, but it tells you how they're engaging with the regional economy. And then the last one will be ministerial media releases, which might give you context about when certain policies are going to start, why they've been agreed to, who's been involved, and those sorts of things. During the year, there are related papers, which I've mentioned in my EFO already, so around the middle of the year you get an update on the budget for 1920. So the 2018-19 one was released around about December, and that tells you what's happened between budget and the mid-year. This budget cycle will see a pre-election fiscal outlook document, which is created by the Secretaries of the Treasury and the Department of Finance. I think it's around 10 days prior to about 10 days prior to the election, and that'll update the budget information. And then you get a final budget outcome and annual reports. So I'll just cover off some of these, some issues that you might face when you're looking at the budget papers. So you might hear the budget sector or the non-budget sector or off-budget sector. What we've been talking about in terms of the appropriation framework, the budget bills, typically deals with the budget sector, which in the language of the government finance statistics is the general government sector, and specifically non-corporate Commonwealth entities. If you hear terminology like off-budget sector, or if you're looking for things that aren't necessarily government departments, you'll be potentially looking at the public non-financial corporations sector or the public financial corporation sector. I won't go into great detail, but when you access this slide, these two links on the bottom will take you to a flip chart which tells you what kind of organisation something you're interested in is, and that will tell you how to find that kind of information. And if you're looking for more detail, there's the Australian Government Organisations Register, which goes into detail on about 1,300 or so Commonwealth Government organisations. So for the appropriation dimension, there's two key types. There's an annual and a special. So the annual deals with the bills 1 through 4 and parliamentary departments. And typically what they're dealing with is portfolio-based funding for... those appropriations are limited by amount. And in total, those annual appropriations account for around about 20% of total government expenditure. The second type of appropriation is a special or a standing appropriation. So these types of appropriations are created by rules. An easy example is the aged pension system or the employment support system. So there'll be a piece of legislation that says these are the eligibility for that program. The budget is appropriated to fund based on that eligibility. So the criteria limits how much the appropriation is, and they account for around about 80% of the total budget. So they're influenced by outside of the budget process. In terms of the annual appropriations, we have the terms administered and departmental against Appropriate Bill 1. It's also covered in Appropriate Bill 2. But effectively, your administered appropriations are things for which a government agency doesn't have control for, but they deliver on behalf of government. Those appropriations are things like health and education payments to the states, grants or subsidies that have been approved, or payments to entities. So the Department of Agriculture might make a payment to the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, so they'll be covered under the administered appropriation. Departmental ones are a little bit more, if you're looking for how much does the government spend on the Department of Social Security, that's what the departmental appropriation would tell you. And it's things for which the agencies have substantial control. So you're looking at salaries, wages, capital, and purchase of supplies. Special accounts are something that get used occasionally for projects where you've got various stakeholders. they're not really bank accounts, but they're amounts of money that are earmarked within the Consolidated Revenue Fund for a purpose that's defined by the rules of the special account. There are two types. The Minister, Finance Minister can make a determination under the Public Governance Performance and Accountability Act, or there can be, again, a piece of specific legislation. So the National Housing Finance Investment Corporation created a special account. It included an appropriation, and that's how that instrument was created. The key point really is that these accounts, they can only be used when a certain set of criteria are met. They're not some kind of a general bank account that can be used without regard for the rules that are set up under. And they're also a limited version of a special appropriation. Because budgets are usually a bit there are risks and contingencies in the economy, the budget has allowances and provisions to deal with that kind of risk. The two key ones that I would suggest that you focus on are the contingency reserve and the advance of the finance minister. So in the functional expenditure statement in budget paper one, you'll find a line that says contingency reserve. That's to cover things like potential unknown parameter variation, which means, well, Liz will talk a bit more about that, maybe some provisions for underspend. There's a conservative bias allowance that's built into that. Or if there's expenditure that is commercial or security and confidence, say, for example, shipbuilding or naval infrastructure, they probably won't define what that is within the budget papers, but it will be covered in the contingency reserve. And also the decisions taken but not yet announced. So the government may make a decision on, say, a new revenue measure or a new expense measure. They'll make a provision for that, but it won't be announced until at some point in the future they appropriate that funding. The other one is the advance to the finance minister. Typically, in each of the appropriation bills, there's an amount set aside that allows for additional funding for unforeseen events during the financial year. The most recent example I can think of that was for the postal vote on same-sex marriage. That was funded through the advance to the finance minister. And just to be clear, you see the word contingent a lot in the budget. There are also contingent liabilities. That's not what these are. Contingent liabilities are a useful view of future risks that are in the budget. They're probably only meaningful if you're looking at some fairly detailed long-term kind of policy. If we just break down very quickly what's actually in the budget documents, so budget paper number one is the top-down view of the budget. In that, typically, you'll get a few statements that deal with things like what's the basic message for the budget, what's the high-level results of the budget, surplus, deficit, net debt, net worth, those sorts of things. It also gives you a sense for what risks face the budget in the 5-year term of the budget. You'll also get a very detailed breakdown of all the revenues and expense at the high level. So if you're at the macro level, you'll find that information there. But probably most interesting, you also get things like the net capital. What are the major asset classes? What's the gross debt versus the net debt? What is it as a percent of GDP? Those sorts of things. You get a breakdown of all that contingent liability in terms of risk and analysis of future events, which Liz will focus on a bit more. And you also get historical data. So it's really the big picture. Budget paper number two, as I've said, new revenue, new expenses, new capital, and you'll see some examples of that very soon, and also how they're costed. Federal financial relations may take a bit of a bigger discussion this year with the changes to the GST, but this really tells you how the $68 billion of GST is distributed and the roughly $60 billion in transfers to the states for specific purpose payments are spread across general revenue and specific payments, the type of instrument and those sorts of things. Budget paper number four, if you start here, if you start from the bottom, if you have an inclination for what you're looking for, if you start with the outcomes statement in budget paper four, that will tell you where to look for information within portfolio budget statements and government departments. You'll also find staffing in this document, so how many staff, average staffing level are there by particular government agencies, and then a full breakdown of the appropriation special accounts and special appropriations. And this is the one that connects appropriations to government agencies. And I'll just leave that there and pass over to Liz.
Okay, so I'm going to focus a bit more on the macro impact and the macro environment in the economy and how that impacts the budget. First of all, just a definition, the distinction between parameter and policy variations. Parameter variations, these are things that are outside the direct control of the government, so it's like a macroeconomic environment. Information about that is me, seminar part two, and it's in budget paper one, as Adrian's already mentioned. Policy variations is directly within the government or parliament's control. That refers to policy decisions such as new expenditure or changes in taxes. That's down to Phil in the part three of the seminar, and that's going to be in budget paper one and budget paper two. So information about policy in papers one and two. So in terms of the economic outlook, I'm going to cover these main areas. First of all, a brief summary about where you can find information on the domestic economy and international economies. Then I'm going to look at three main issues, which you should probably keep in mind when you're looking at this macro data, should you be doing so. First of all, forecasts for macro variables will vary by institution. So it depends who makes the forecast as to how what they come up with. Even within institutions, you will get revisions to these forecasts over time. And lastly, but most importantly, is forecasts are uncertain, and how can we measure this uncertainty? I'm going to look at confidence intervals and sensitivity analysis. So looking at budget paper one, statement one, there's a nice summary table for the Treasury's estimates of major economic parameters. These are set out in the same way each time. The first column gives you the outcome. So this is the latest, this is from last year's budget paper. So at the time, the latest actual data was for 2016-17, and the first column gives you the actual outcome. This is ABS data. Then the next three columns give you forecasts. These are Treasury forecasts for the current financial year, the budget year, and the following financial year. And they're based on Treasury modelling, which includes surveys, business liaison, professional judgment. And that's how they come up with these forecasts. And then the last 2 years are projections. Now, these are different from forecasts. They're derived in a different way. And they assume that there's some long-run potential or long-run level for which each of these variables is going to reach. And so then these numbers here, for example, are driving you towards that long-run or potential level. And at the time of this budget, the long-run or potential level for real GDP was thought to be about 2.75%. So what they're saying is that we expect, on average, over the long term, real GDP, real growth, is going to be about 2.75%. And so we're going to work towards that. The potential level is assumed to be reached 5 years after the end of the forecast period. So if this number is bigger than 2.75, which it is, that means that they expect the economy to grow faster to try and reach that long-run level, because it's not there right now. The long-run level for unemployment is assumed to be about 5%, and for the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, it's 2.5%, which is the midway, the band between of the RBA target. So that's a summary table of major domestic parameters, and you'll find more information about the domestic economy in that statement too. In terms of international economies, there's quite a lot of information, but this gives you a summary table of where the growth outlook is for different economies. And this is comprised of Treasury data, IMF, and selected national statistical agencies. So you'll notice that these are year-end rather than mid-year. So for 2017, for example, world growth was 3.8%. That's real GDP growth was 3.8%. And the forecast is for it, at the time last year's budget, was for it to be 3.75%. So a slight decline, but not much. Recent IMF forecasts have got this number at 3.7 and this one at 3.5. So the IMF is looking at a bit more of a slowdown. In terms of the budget, which is important here, it's the major trading partners. This is going to affect the economy, the Australian economy most. And we can see here that that's from 4.6% in 2017, there's a bit of a decline to 4.25%. We don't actually know which countries are included in major trading partners. It's not defined in the budget papers. But China was responsible in 2017-18 for 24% of two-way trade between Australia and China. The next biggest was the Euro area at 13%, then Japan at 10%, and the US at 9%. So the major, it sort of includes these countries, but we're not sure what's in there. In terms of China, because it has such a big impact on the economy, it's important to know what's happening or what's likely to happen, and there's a general slowdown in the growth rate. It's still pretty big, but it is slowing down. So, coming to those three things that are important to look at when you're looking at forecasts. Forecasts will vary by institution. What I've got here is estimates of Australian real GDP growth for three different institutions. The IMF, an international institution, Oxford Economics, a consultancy firm, and Treasury's forecasts. Treasury forecasts are mid-year, which is why they're little diamonds in the middle, and the IMF and Oxford Economics are year-end, so they're the columns. Forecasts start from 2018-19. This is from last year's budget. So what we can see is that Treasury forecasts are quite a bit more optimistic than those in the IMF or Oxford Economics. The more optimistic your forecast of the domestic economy, the more optimistic your forecast for fiscal outcomes are likely to be. So if you've got this wrong, you might be getting something else wrong in the budget. Even within an organisation, your forecasts are going to vary over time. Now, this chart shows Australian wage growth, and the black line is the actual data measured by the wage price index from the ABS. So wage growth has fallen from 2011-12 down to 2016-17. There's a little bit of an uptick in 2017-18. What these other multicoloured lines show is the budget forecasts at a particular budget for where they expected wages to grow, to go. Sorry. So in 2013-14, for example, they expected that by 2012-13, wage growth would be 3.5%. It wasn't, it was actually all the way down here, below 3%. Over time, all these budget, these lines are over time. The most recent is MAIFO from 2018-19, which is December of last year. The government is expecting a very strong recovery in wages. This hasn't happened. As we can see, it's going down like that. So we've just got to be a little bit aware that although there are forecasts in the budget, they're not always going to turn out as expected. Also, I've just tacked on here a little RBA. They've recently started producing forecasts for some major economic indicators, and as of February 2019, excuse me, they're expecting wage growth for about 2.5%, whereas MAIFO is still persisting in 3% a year. Why does this matter? Again, if you have over-optimistic economic predictions, they're going to feed through into over-optimistic fiscal predictions. Another way of measuring uncertainty is to look at something called confidence intervals. This shows, this is taken from Budget Paper 1 last year. It's to do with the risks and analysis section of Statement 8 in Budget Paper 1. And it shows you government predictions of nominal GDP growth. Now, nominal GDP growth includes price effects and output effects. And for Australia, the price effects that are most important in terms of volatility are commodity prices. No one seems to be able to predict those with any degree of success. So this is where nominal GDP growth has been actual, this black line, and then it's forecast to be around 4% from 2016-17. The confidence interval is this dark grey, these shaded areas. The dark grey area is a 70% confidence interval. All that means is that Treasury is 70% confident that the real value for the growth rate of nominal GDP is in this range from here to here. So it's about 2.75 to 5.5%. So although they're saying that nominal GDP growth will be 4%, it could be between 2.75 and 5.5. And they're 90% confident that it'll lie between about 2 and 6%. This is a big range, okay? So we just need to keep that in mind, that if you see a growth rate predicted 4%, actually it might be a big range. Another way of looking at uncertainty is to create a scenario, and this is taken from my EFO from last year, an example that's looking at commodity prices. As I've already mentioned, they're very volatile, they're very hard to predict. So what Treasury did here was look at what happens if, for example, non-rural commodity prices are 10% higher than we thought they're going to be. Now, non-rural commodities are things like iron ore, coal, metals, minerals, things like that. So suppose the price of those products goes up, the export price goes up by 10%, what impact is this going to have on A, the economy, and B, the budget? So increasing in export prices of commodities is good for Australia because we export lots of commodities, approximately. And so what happens is nominal GDP goes up, income goes up, employment goes up, wages go up, real output goes up, everything goes up. This is good news for the economy. Unemployment goes down, hopefully. That's not there, but if employment's going up, that's good. Company profits go up quite substantially. How does this feed through into the budget? Well, we've got, I've just printed out the bit on the effect on receipts. So this is tax receipts that the government will now get. If company profits are going up 3.25% after 2 years, this has a big impact on company tax receipts. They're expected to go up by 3.2 billion. There is an impact on payments, but it's not very big, so I haven't included it here. The overall impact on the underlying cash balance is 2.2 billion in the first year and 5.9 billion in the second year. So a 10% increase in commodity prices has a pretty big impact on the underlying cash balance after 2 years. Drilling down a little bit more, what about if the price of iron ore goes up by $10 a ton? It's measured in US dollars. So it can either go up or go down by $10. What impact does this have on the budget? Using the modelling based on the previous scenario, and we know from DFAT data that iron ore accounted for about 15% of all exports in 2017-18, so it's quite a big impact. Nominal GDP, if there's an increase in price, will go up by 5.5 billion in the first year and 12.3 billion in the second year. So a $10 increase has a massive impact on nominal GDP, and that feeds through to tax receipts, which go up by more than 3.5 billion in the second year. Now, just to put this in some context, a $10 per tonne. In March 2018, the price of iron ore was about $70 per tonne. As of last week, it had gone up to $86 per tonne. Both last year's budget and my EFO assumed that the price was $55 per tonne. So it's $30 more than was assumed in the budget. And you can see that even with a $10 increase, it has a big impact on the budget and tax receipts. That's basically what I'm going to say. Just to conclude, the macro statistics, you'd be interested, are very easy to find in the budget. But what I'd like you to do is to just be a little bit cautious about point estimates, recognise that there's some uncertainty, and that uncertainty will feed through from the economic into the fiscal predictions. And I'll hand over to Phil, who'll talk about policy variations.
So as both Liz and Adrian mentioned, policy variations are the variations in the fiscal position of government, which are the direct impact of the decisions made by government. So what you're looking at here is essentially Budget Paper 2, which outlines all the policy measures that the government's decided to take or will seek to legislate over the next budget period. So essentially what Budget Paper 2 is a list of what are called budget measures, which will include two things essentially. A costing, which is the expected financial impact of the policy, and a description of what the policy is. So I'll break down these a little bit more. So I'll start with talking about what is a costing. What is a costing? So a costing is an assessment of the impact of the policy against the budget baseline. And what I mean by that is, how does the fiscal position of government change from the previous estimated fiscal position? So here we're talking about MIEFO. So it's not the total effect of, say, if it was a social security measure, it's not the total social security cost, it's just the change. It's just the change in social security expenditure as a result of the measure. So what is a costing? Well, a costing includes some things, it doesn't include all things. So costing includes what are called, so take for example an increase in tobacco excise. So the price of, so the government increases the amount of tax that it applies to each cigarette sold. So costing will include the direct static impact. So what I mean by that is that because of the tax, there'll be an increased tax on each cigarette sold, so the revenue of government will go up. Also, as a result of this, behaviour will change, so people will presumably smoke less cigarettes. So there'll be a counteracting effect, much smaller, through a reduction in cigarette sales. Now, what the costing won't tend to include is things called second-round impacts. So what I'm talking about here is, say, for example, cigarette companies sell their cigarettes, so there's lower company tax revenues. The costing might not necessarily include those second-round impacts. And the other thing that it probably won't include is, say, people smoke less, they're healthier, won't include reduced health costs. There's a bit of a grey area because some really large budget measures, say you introduce GST or something like that, that might have enough of an economic impact that Treasury might decide it's worth including some more second-round impacts. So there's a bit of a grey area there. But essentially, a costing is generally just the first round direct impact and direct behavioural impacts of the policy. I picked this costing because it's probably one of the more complex to look at, but essentially what I want to point out is a few aspects of the costing. So this is a revenue measure. Most budget measures will be either revenue or expense, but some will have the impact on taxes from the policy. Some will have a related expense. So particularly with tax measures, you might see this where there's changes in the systems of government. So if they need to hire new staff, or they need to or the department needs more funding to implement a policy, then there might be some related departmental expenditure. And you might see some related capital. So what that might be, say, introducing new computer systems or something like that, where the government is buying an asset that's not just an expenditure. Another thing to keep in mind about budget costings is that they're presented over a five-year period. So the current year, so at the moment, this is an old one, we're in 18-19. The budget year, which is the year starting on the 1 July immediately following the budget. So for this year, that'll be, it's the 19-20 budget. And then 3 years of the forward estimates period. So they're the projection years. And one thing to keep in mind is even though costings are only presented over this period, they can have ongoing financial impacts over what's called the medium or long term. So medium term, usually about 10 years, and long term beyond that. And another thing to keep in mind is that the profile of the costing and the expense and the costing might not be illustrative of the ongoing effects of the costing. So if you take the government's personal income tax plan from last year, for example, that had stage changes in personal income taxes, some which occurred beyond the end of the forward estimates, where the cost of that policy actually increased over time. And another thing which I'll talk about just now, I don't know if you can see this, but this another reason why I chose this particular one is that there's negative revenue effects, positive revenue effects, negative expenditure effects. So those signs can be a little bit confusing, so I'll go through those now. So on the revenue side, a positive number indicates an increase in revenue, so an increase in tax, which translates to a better fiscal position. Whereas a negative number is a decrease in revenue, so a worse fiscal position. You have to flip your thinking a little bit with expenditure measures. So in the expense statement of budget, a positive number is an increase in expense, which is a worse fiscal position, and a negative number is a decrease in expense. Capital measures are much the same, so a positive number there is an increase in capital expenditure, also an increase in the capital of the government, so the assets of the government, and a negative number is a decrease in capital expenditure and subsequently a decrease in assets. I'll move on to the second part of the measure. So, measure description. words in it aren't important, but I just wanted to point out a few things. So often the way a measure description will be structured is to talk about what the policy does. And one thing to keep in mind is that it doesn't neatly translate into one policy change per measure. Sometimes there could be multiple policy changes wrapped up in the one measure. So the measure description should highlight all the changes that are made. After that, you'll usually get a proposed start date, so that'll tell you when the policy is expected to start. There'll be a summary of the fiscal impact, so what does it cost over the forward estimates period, generally. And then, often with budget measures, there'll be media releases that have been released on budget night or before budget night, which provide more information on the policy. And it'll often have details of where to find that additional information. But sometimes, just a couple of things to keep in mind. So measures are costed over the forward estimates period, like I said. Just be mindful that that might not be reflective of the ongoing cost, and you have to sort of understand the policy a little bit to understand how those costings might change. The detail might not be in the measure description or materials that are released around budget night, so you might get a bit of information, some high-level information on the policy, but ultimately the details of the measure might not be known until a later date and might not be known until the legislation comes before Parliament, for example, in which case the Treasury, the Parliamentary Library's Bills Digest can help with understanding that. And one thing that I'll just highlight here, and I can go into more detail if people are interested, is that costings are done on an accrual basis, so that means it affects revenue expenses, and the difference between, rather than a cash basis, so the difference between that is essentially revenues, that accrual basis recognises costs and expenses when you incur them, whereas the cash impact represents the time at which the cash goes out or the cash comes in. And there can be a lag, say, a 30-day invoice period or something might be a lag between the revenue expense side, an expense and a payment. And just to tie everything back to policy and parameter variations, so this is a chart we did at the MIEFO. So you can see what this shows is the change in the underlying cash balance, so the surplus, essentially, or the deficit, as a result of parameter variations in the grey, so the stuff that Liz was talking about. So in this case, the economic forecasts were more positive than what was announced at the 2018-19 budget. So you can see you get a boost in the underlying cash balance as a result of improved economic conditions. But the policy decisions of government, so the tax and expenditure decisions of government, counteracted that, and you get a smaller negative impact from policy decisions. So I guess that ties together both sides of the budget. So when you're looking at the overall impact of the budget, say you want to know about surplus, then you can see how the economic effects and the policy decisions affect that. And that's all I wanted to talk about, so we'll leave some time for questions. Thank you. Just some more information, the contact details for the library if you have any questions for us after this presentation or after the budget.
Thanks, Phil, Adrian and Liz. Does anybody have any questions? A question. To give you a bit of a signal about what sort of help we can give you with the budget, I'll ask a couple of dixes of the panel. If I'm a political advisor and I want to know, say, whether funding for the ABC has gone up or down, is that the sort of thing you can help me with?
Yes.
Straightforward thing. What about if I wanted to know about funding for regional Australia in the budget? Mm. Is that similarly straightforward?
No. So you've got sort of two sides to a coin. So the ABC is an entity that's set out under the government's framework. So it's a standalone part of the Department of Communications portfolio. ABC will have its own financial statement in its own portfolio budget statement. In that, it will tell you at a high level how much appropriation was transferred to the ABC under something called the revenue from government. That can typically be tracked across a number of financial years. It'll tell you how much has been spent on employees, supplies, all those various sorts of things. So it's a sort of a discrete unit that we can actually track, and you can match it to annual reports and all those sorts of things. If you go to something like regional Australia, it suffers from a number of things. First is, what is regional Australia? How do you define that? What are we actually looking at in terms of government expenditure? Are you looking at, say, the payments that individuals receive through the social security system, the health system, transfers to the states that end up within the regions, Regional Development Australia kind of grant programs, and all that sort of stuff. So it's a big term. That's where this document is actually... So with budgets with the regional, they might do a statement like this, and you can go through it, and this is what government will tell you by portfolio is being done within each of the regions.
So this is a one-off publication on regional
Australia. Yeah, it's been for a couple of years, yeah. So it's been a couple of years. So I think from memory, that, like, historically, there's been things like the budget impact on women, jobs and investment programs. So there's some glossies and things where the government will package up a bunch of things into a theme. But tracking back what is actually accounted for within that bucket and then linking that backwards over time to work out how it's changed, which is usually what people are focusing on, is significantly more difficult. So that's the linking. So whether, usually if there's something that's actually appropriated, it's extremely interested. Directly appropriated or through a portfolio, it's relatively easy. Something a bit more wide like that is more complicated. It can sort of be done, but not easily.
Is there a breakdown by the states?
For which bit, sorry?
As you were talking about regions.
Yes.
Can you identify... Is there any way that you can look at each state by state?
So for where Commonwealth has made a transfer under the Federal Financial Relations System, that's spelled out in a lot of detail in Budget Paper Number 3. Okay. So that's for things like, say, National Education Partnership, National Health Partnership, Infrastructure Investment Program, all those sorts of things that are agreements between the Commonwealth and the states. If you're looking at departmental expenses or other programs that aren't covered under that sort of stuff, it can sometimes be done if we know what kind of program or government agency that you're looking at, but that's not from what's published in the budget papers. That'll be going back through their annual reports. Or you take something like... So grants and contracts would be two other types of payments from the Commonwealth. So there's a massive grant program. There's a Grant Connect database which gives us information on, I can't remember how many grants, but it covers 33 government agencies that has postcodes and states, so we can drill down into that to tell you what grant programs are spent in the state. There's a contracts database that gives you anything that's gone through AusTender as a purchase from government. We can break that down by state. Some things like tax stats or... even Australian Bureau of Statistics summary data sometimes has the expenditure by the Commonwealth in the state. So it just depends on the nature of the question and how far you want to go.
So we'd probably have to ask you for that separately.
Well, I think the best, like most jobs, the first thing is you determine what it is that you want to know.
Say defence, for example. How much defence expenditure in each state?
Yeah, so say for defence, they do some summary of things like major projects by state. Right. I don't think they do operational expenditures by state, but you may be able to dig into the annual reports and sort of, if they've got segment reporting, sometimes you're lucky. Sometimes they have very specific things. But I know with Defence particularly, they have major projects by state. Actually, I think they also publish them by electorate. So if it has to be first classified as a major project, then they'll have to do the presentation of it, and that gives you the big bucket. So we're information takers in that way.
Any other questions? I think the point of my questions to the panel was that there are some things which are plainly visible in the budget papers and easy to find, but there are some things, no matter how hard you look for, you won't find recorded in the way that you want to find the information. The presentation, the video of the presentation, is on our website at that address, and so are the PowerPoints and other resources related to the budget that we've been publishing. You can contact us on 2500 if you're calling within the building or on that library, that email address. Thank you for coming. Thank you for the panel. And see you next year.